For the last couple of months, I've been hosting this series we've been doing on what the Buddha called the three marks or the three characteristics of existence, anicca, anatta, and dukkha. All of these teachings in one way or another emanate from the discourses of the Buddha as first recorded in writing in a set of books called the Pali Canon, okay, which is the first transcribed teachings of the historical Buddha that we're aware of. And sort of the mother discourse in this tradition, in this set of teachings, is the Mahi Satipatthana Sutta, or the Greater Discourse on the Establishing of Mindfulness. And in that, when the Buddha lays out step by step his teachings about why we have suffering and how suffering may be brought to an end. And after he has laid out the basic instructions on how to do this practice, mindfulness practice, the next thing he starts doing is teaching about things that get in the way. That create difficulty, that create obstacles. And one of the sets of teachings that he does right there in the middle of the Greater Discourse on the Foundations of Mindfulness, he basically says, as the mind becomes more calm and clear and still, and as mindfulness begins to grow, then here's a bunch of stuff that's gonna come along that you're gonna have to deal with. And so he had this set of teachings, it's called the hindrances or the obstacles to concentration. And so for the next 2 months here, on the evenings that I teach, which are we meet every Sunday night, but I teach on the second and fourth Sundays of each month. And for the next 2 months, we're going to be doing a series on the hindrances, on the obstacles to concentration. There are five of them. Lust or extreme craving, anger and aversion, what the text called sloth and torpor, or basically an act of desire to not see or to not know. Restlessness and anxiety and doubt. And so we're going to spend some time together looking with care at each one of those, and to the extent that any of us is comfortable doing so, to share our own experiences working with them and working through them. So I just wanted to give a heads up, and I've been trying to organize my teachings actually into sets. You know, I'm kind of going through the Buddha's list here, and so that's next on the list. So that's what we'll be doing for the rest of March and April and a little bit into May. Okay. So you'll be all ready when you go to Carol's retreat. To recognize everything that's going to come up.
Okay. Can I ask a quick question?
Yes.
You had a pair for everything except doubt. It was like sloth and torpor, restlessness and anxiety, lust and something, anger and something, but doubt was just doubt.
Just good old doubt. Yeah. When you hit doubt, that's when you know you've really gotten someplace. Right?
I didn't know if there was a...
If none of the other stuff works, then doubt's going to get you if nothing else does. All right. So... these three aspects of existence that the Buddha described as being fairly universal, they sound kind of matter-of-fact in one way, and yet in another, he was offering teachings that were quite new and that he actually described as going against the grain or against the stream. The reason for that is that the inclination of our minds is to see things as permanent and unchanging, okay? To see things as substantial. And what he was teaching basically was that at its very root, okay, in terms of our understanding of the nature of reality, the only thing that is dependable is change. That all is in a state of flux. Everything is in a continuous state of arising and changing and ceasing. Arising and changing and ceasing. which is actually something you may have noted as you were sitting this evening, right? Did you stay in one stable, constant state of mind the whole time? No. It may have been like floating around in a mill pond, or it may have been like a class 5 rapids, right? But you were flowing along. You were moving from one thing to the next, to the next, to the next. Okay. So, ceaseless change, anicca. Okay. Not stable, not solid. Anatta, insubstantiality. Insubstantiality of everything that seems to us to be substantial, to be real, to be hard. You know, the physicists will tell us that even the things we consider to be stable and solid and permanent, like the chairs we're sitting on or this building itself, the molecules of the things that make it up are in a constant state of motion, okay? And it's a constant state of entropy, actually. And that everything that we like to think of as solid is in fact changing, right? We like to think of the earth as solid and unchanging. And that kind of works unless you live in California. Or you're driving along Highway 6 someday in the spring, right? And some big boulder decides to take you out, right? So that which we think of as permanent and abiding is in fact ceaselessly changing. That which we think of as substantial is in fact not. And once the realization of these two realities comes fully into focus, for most of us, certainly for the discursive mind, it's a bummer, right? It's not necessarily very good news, because that part about things being insubstantial, right? That includes us. Yeah. We are just as ceaselessly changing as everything else that's out there, because we are part of everything that's out there, right? And that's a cause of sort of consternation, right? A cause of dissatisfaction, a cause of distress. And the Pali word for that is dukkha, okay? D-U-K-K-H-A. And the etymology of dukkha is actually sort of two words put together in the Pali. Du means dirty or unpleasant or unsatisfactory. Okay. Ka means space. Okay. So to experience dukkha literally is to be in a bad space, right? So if you have ever used, like, you know, some of us did in the 60s or 70s, right? How are you doing? Well, I'm in a really bad space. That's dukkha, right? That is something that is difficult to bear. It's something that's unpleasant. Okay. Among the Tibetan teachers, the Dzogchen meditation teachers, one of the objects they have on their altars that they use a lot is a crystal. And the way they use it in their tradition, it's a simile for human consciousness. And in their teaching, in that worldview, there is a primordial light, okay, that's out there, the source from which everything comes and to which everything returns. And in this understanding, the primordial light strikes the crystal, which is human consciousness. Okay. And then when light strikes a crystal, it's refracted, right? It's projected onto the room around you. So in the wintertime, sometimes we hang crystals in the south-facing windows in our home, and you can see these little rainbow patterns that are being projected around the room, you know, at certain hours of the day. And so what they're doing is using this object to say, that's pretty much how human consciousness works. Okay. This primordial light strikes our consciousness, you know, and then it's projected onto the space around us. Okay. And depending on what's going on in the human mind, okay, what we're looking at when we see the space around us, the environment around us, is literally a projection of our own minds. Okay. So if our mind state is one that is imbued with generosity and with kindness and with goodwill toward other people and whatnot, then that's what we tend to see when we look around us. Okay, if we're feeling relaxed and unafraid and open, then there is this nature, there is this tendency to see the beauty in the world. Okay. And to really feel like we are one with it, that we are not separate from it. Okay. That we're simply abiding in this awareness, you know, like the Navajo blessing, you know, may you walk in beauty. Okay. So it's that experience of kind of this essential integrity of the environment, the existence of which we're a part. If, on the other hand, the mind is imbued with a sense of anger or distrust or fear or a disinclination to simply see things as they are, then that's what we see when we look around us. Okay. In the Talmud, it says we see things not as they are, but as we are. Okay. And that's what this teaching is trying to get at as well. So, in an anxious state, everything we see around us is a potential threat. If we are in a state of craving, of desire, then everything we see around us tends to be an object of desire. We're hungrily looking for something out there to fulfill us. These states of anger and aversion and delusion, actually, as the Buddha taught, are simply neuroscientists talk about now, it's basically just the mind in a hyperactive state. Because to some extent, these abilities to seek out, to recognize, and to seek out and attain the pleasurable, and to recognize and withdraw from and avoid the threatening, okay, and to block out everything that's not one of them, okay, that's the hard wiring that made it possible for us as a species to be here, right? So it certainly has its uses. What's happened, again, you know, I'm drawing from a lot of different ideas about all this now, but as a way of trying to better understand the Dharma, is that somehow or another, evolutionarily, it seems like we got kind of off in a little cul-de-sac someplace, where we've come to the conclusion that that's all there is to human consciousness. You know, seek pleasure, avoid pain, live forever. Right? That's really all there is to it, that's what we're wired to do, and that's just how it is, and therefore, that is how we see the world around us. That basically the consciousness does little more than seek out the pleasurable, avoid the unpleasant, and ignore everything else. That, says the Buddha, is dukkha. Okay. The mind has become enslaved in those three habitual forms of behavior. Okay. And is unable to step aside from them. Is unable to recognize when the urgency of those three forces is inappropriate and unnecessary. Similarly, I know that some of you have heard me use before, has to do with when I was stationed as a medical corpsman with the Marine Corps in Vietnam. When you go into a combat zone, there are certain things that the mind-body process needs to learn in a great big hurry in order to survive, you know, and it's things that cannot be taught when you're back stateside, okay. You have to very quickly learn to interpret certain sights and sounds as a way of understanding, like, the difference between the sound of an incoming rocket and an outgoing rocket, right? big, it's very useful to be able to make that distinction, right? Believe me. The year I was in Vietnam, as was the case throughout the time that the Marines were in Vietnam, 70% of the casualties were experienced by people either in their first 2 months in the country or the last 30 days. First 2 months was because you hadn't yet learned these split-second survival behaviors, right? You get them under your belt, and then you kind of adopt this sense of optimistic fatalism where you very much live in the moment and your senses are very attuned to what's going on around you. Your situational awareness is remarkably heightened for all the time you're there. The reason that the people, at the other end, the problem becomes that, you know, because basically when you're living moment to moment, you basically give up hope you stop thinking about going home, right? Because your job is just to stay completely aware in the moment and live for each moment, which is actually one of the reasons for the enduring popularity of war. You know, it's a way to stay in the present without having to do what we're doing, you know, sit all the time. But at any rate, when you get up towards your last month in country, then all of a sudden it's like, wow, I may actually get out of here, you know? And then you start being too careful and too jumpy. And we didn't really like to be around people who were close to going home because you couldn't really trust their behavior anymore. They were losing their timing, right? And so after a while, they even started stop sending them out on patrol because they're too dangerous to be around. But you learn this set of behaviors that keeps you alive there. The problem is, and this is the same for pretty much any returning combat veteran, these highly attuned responses to environmental stimuli that keep you alive when you're in a combat situation all of a sudden don't necessarily serve you so well when you're back in the world, as we would call it, you know. In my particular case, I was going to the University of Arizona in Tucson, and there was an Air Force base right outside of town where there was a training squadron for the kind of fighters that were flying low, close air support for us when we were in the jungle dropping napalm. And so you wanted to duck and cover when they were coming through, because if they pushed a button a half second too soon, you're all going to get fried like chickens. So you learn that sound is associated with a certain possibility. And so I'd be walking across campus and all of a sudden I'd find myself under a car, you know, with my books scattered all around and people looking at me weird, you know. It was one of the instantaneous responses that kept me alive in Vietnam, but it really didn't have much of a role to play at the University of Arizona in Tucson, okay. And it took me actually quite a while for the mind-body process to settle down and to realize that those responses that were so appropriate and necessary at this one point no longer were. So to some extent, the same thing is going on for each of us. We're living in this heightened state of awareness, okay, for dangers that may not really be there, tending to see threats when there aren't, which does not mean that these reactions have no place, especially for people who may have experienced trauma and other kinds of circumstances, you know. The same thing happens to people who've been highly traumatized, whether through physical violence or extreme psychological, trauma over periods of time, get equally heightened, equally attuned to danger, right? And equally hypersensitive, because the mind-body process is trying to do everything possible to keep that harm from happening again, to protect us. And so we tend to get hypersensitized, you know. If we've grown up in a state of privation, right? There's that, you know, that Hindu adage that, you know, whether a pickpocket is in a crowded bazaar with other shoppers or a holy temple with other worshippers, he still sees only pockets. You know, if you're in a constant state of need, of, you know, always seeking that which you don't have, then you see it. Then that's all that the mind is doing. It's looking out there for what you don't have that you may want to acquire. So when we do insight meditation practice, these are all forms of dukkha, these are all forms of unsatisfactoriness. You know. When we're doing insight meditation practice, All we're doing is agreeing to simply sit back and watch the mind do whatever it is the mind's going to do. You know, if you've experienced recent or powerful trauma, the mind might be reliving some of those traumatic experiences, okay? And reliving not only the memories, but also the emotions that were associated with them. You know, when I do meditation retreats that the combat veterans or the people that have experienced severe psychological or physical trauma, you know, a lot of the time is spent being able to, and this is how this practice can be, you know, the healing power of this practice, what you do is you seek to disaggregate the facts of the memory from the emotions that the memory aroused. That's the dealing with the past part. For those who have been severely traumatized, also what tends to happen is not just memories of the difficult, but anxiety about the possible future recurrence of something of that nature. And so the mind will think about that as well, the possibility of something bad happening in the future, and trying to stay on guard against that happening. So when we do insight meditation practice, the way that it differs from some other wisdom traditions and some other practices is that we're not trying to transcend that or to make it go away. Okay. All we're really trying to do when we do this practice is to recognize it for what it is. To just sit and be with whatever the mind happens to be experiencing at that point in time. It may be a difficult emotion, a disturbing memory. It may be a really pleasant memory. The memory of somebody who did something for you that was very generous, that warmed your heart. Okay? And so you can have the memory of that event, and then you may feel the warmth in your heart. You may feel the heart that's been touched by love. Okay? And that warmed you and freed you up and made you a little happier as a result. All we're doing when we're doing insight meditation is to watch this going on. So it's like we're standing a little to one side of the crystal on the Dzogchen teacher's altar. We're watching the primordial light come in and strike our own consciousness, and then we're watching the projections in the space around us. But instead of being inside the crystal and seeing nothing but the environment and supposing that to be real, what we're doing when we do insight meditation practice is that we're standing just a little to one side so we can watch the whole thing go on. Okay. And watch the arising of primordial pure consciousness, and then watch what happens as we look about. You know, when we're sitting doing this practice with our eyes closed, you know, it's all coming up in the mind. And what I'm talking about is this bringing together of memories, of emotions, of thoughts about the future. This is a realm of mental activity. In the Pali Canon, this is referred to as the sankharas, okay, sometimes called mental factors, but it's actually pretty much the sum total of our remembered experience and the impact that it has on the way the mind thinks not only about the past but about the future. Okay. So that's where we take the sense stimuli and the consciousness and it all comes together, and it's the sort of cauldron within which we stew up the self. So all we're doing when we do insight meditation practice is to stand to one side a little and observe that process occurring. And the real value of doing this practice is that whenever we're standing aside, observing the process occurring, we're not in the middle of it. It's like one of the teachers talks about our minds spending a great deal of time paying homage to your I-ness, Your royal highness. So when we're sitting on the throne, right, and looking around, whoa, here I am, you know, everyone's worshiping me, especially me. But when we're just to one side, you know, and when we're maybe his or her highness's counselor, or better angels of our own nature, you know, we can sit to one side and say, oh, is that so, really? Is that really who you are? Who are you conjuring up now? What's going on there? Okay. And the way this process naturally progresses is that if we're sitting there carefully watching what the mind's up to, okay, if we can see that what the mind is doing is remembering a really happy or pleasant event, or is remembering or is experiencing unity with another being, is experiencing love or whatnot, then we can feel love for ourselves. We can feel sympathetic joy for ourselves, okay, in that state of mind. If, on the other hand, this is one of the reasons that I usually try to sit as early as possible in the morning after I get up and have some tea or something to help, you know, get all, so I'm firing on LA. The first thing that I like to do is sit so I can just settle in just to see what the mind's up to that morning. Okay. So I can see, okay, what kind of movies am I projecting onto my environment? Who am I this morning? You know, like Sogyen Rinpoche, one of his Dzogchen teachers, says, and I asked him if it's ever skillful. Because, you know, a lot of the iconic iconography in that tradition is these horrific demons slaying ego and whatnot. I asked him once, is it ever skillful in order to just try to befriend the self? You know, I said, yeah, I said, I try to do it every morning. And I get up there and stand in front of the mirror and kind of, morning self, how are you? You know, and shaves. So it's not as if he's trying to stifle the self creating the self. It's just not taking the whole thing too seriously, you know. Because as we embark on this journey, and we can see what the mind's doing, you know, stirring up a nice batch of me every morning, and getting in trouble, you know, as a result, in one way or another. Then the next, once the mind, the discursive mind, realizes that's what's going on, then the discursive mind says, "Well, I'm not going to do that anymore." Except the discursive mind cannot not do it. That's what it's designed to do. So because of the frustration of the fact that you resolve not to creating a self, but it's the self resolving to not create the self, doesn't work like that, right? And so since it doesn't work like that, then you start to get frustrated, and that generates a certain amount of self-aversion. You know, literal aversion to the self. The simile that Buddha used for that is a dog chained to a post. You know, jerking and barking and trying and lunging to get free of the post. Okay. All the dog does when he does that is to hurt himself. And so the Buddha said, that's just like having an aversive relationship with the self. If you're tugging and jerking, all you do is hurt yourself, because the self can never rid the self of the self. The only way to be rid of the self is to cease construing it. Is to cease conjuring it. Okay. So when the mindfulness gets pretty deep and pretty solid, and you've gotten pretty good at watching the mind create the self, little bit by little bit, then you can help the mind to relax to the point where every once in a while, it just no longer does it. So once you can kind of work through the aversive part, the aversion to self, then the real beauty of the practice begins to manifest, because you're actually, at the same time, it feels like you're just letting go of all control. In fact, what you've actually done is to have found the master switch that turns the self off and on. And so every once in a while, you get to the point where the mind is so steady and so calm and so clear, okay, that it ceases to create the self. Can be, the self-aversion can be particularly difficult when you're experiencing difficult states of mind. So in the morning when I'm sitting, if for whatever reason I'm just, you know, I have really bad dreams, or I'm going to have to go to a meeting at work I really don't want to attend, I know it isn't going to be pleasant, or something is going on that is bumming me out, has got me for whatever reason, you know, neurochemicals or whatever, and I'm not great in a bad space, right? You can sort of inattentively and reactively and aversively inhabit the bad space, or when the mindfulness is pretty good, you can again be sitting to one side, be your own spiritual friend, and regard yourself and what's going on in the mind with compassion. Oh wow, that must hurt. I'm sorry, I'm sad that you're experiencing this difficulty. So when you hear teachers like Sharon Salzberg and others say the suffering is the gateway to compassion, that's what's being talked about. That when the mindfulness is pretty strong and you can kind of move your awareness to one side of this process of I making and me making, you know, and say, oh, his I-ness is sad this morning. And feel compassion. Okay? So as we move on over the next couple of months and start talking about the hindrances, I'll also be talking about how to transform them into teachers, into opportunities for spiritual growth. And that's actually a kind of a four-part process, the first part being what we're talking about right now, which is to sit mindfully and simply be aware of what's coming up in the mind, whether you like what you see or you don't. You know, just, oh, okay, there's that. So awareness, acknowledgement of the fact that it's arising, and then acceptance of the fact that it's arising in a non-aversive way. And an inquiry into why it's arising is what becomes possible next. And at that point is when this transformation can really occur, when what you've seen as an obstacle or a hindrance instead becomes an insight teacher and allows a greater degree of freedom to be experienced. Okay, let's talk about this stuff. Anyone have some questions or comments? It's all perfectly clear then. Congratulations. Well, then somebody here must have gained enlightenment. Okay, Jim, please.
I have. So.
Okay, good. Yeah.
Ever so commonly.
Yes, sir.
I saw the film Wild. I don't know how many people have seen the film Wild. How many people who've seen it agree with me that he talked about some of this? In the film Wild, this stuff is there. So if you go to see the film Wild, you might remember this.
What are some of the insights that it seemed to you that the film brought forth?
Well, suffering is the gateway to compassion. That is the big one. Have you seen it?
No.
No. Okay. I don't want to give it away, but it's, you know, my expectation of the film was pretty superficial, and this film is not superficial.
Yeah, that's pretty close to the core of Buddha Dharma. Actually. Yeah, good. Thank you. Paul?
When we talk about aversion, it seems as if, for me, that there's a step that comes before the aversion, and that is the judgment. Could you help me understand a little more about, is that...
Why do you think that judging yourself ill comes before aversion?
Well, for me not to like something, I have to judge, make some decision about, this is good,
pleasant,
this is not good,
yeah.
This is pleasant, this is...
Yes.
So the judgment precedes the aversion, and possibly, I suppose, also precedes the chasing after those things that are pleasurable. Oh yes, that's mm-hmm. really nice, I like that, let me do some more of that. So where in the lexicon does judgment come in with the...
You know, the Buddha's teachings about, you know, when he says that his teachings on not self on that which we take to be a permanent and abiding self literally is not, but it's rather moment-to-moment construct of the mind. And he talks about the five ingredients that go into making the self. The body and its capability of receiving sensory input, okay. And then he says immediately, and he's talking about the very process, the assembly line now, and the coming together, that immediately upon being aware that sensory input has occurred, okay, before it's even given a name, that the mind makes an immediate judgment, pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. It's called vedana. Okay, it's the immediate precognitive response. Okay, then, and that basically that's survival mode mental activity, because again, you know, you have to be able to, especially like, you know, when I was talking about being at war, you have to immediately judge the sound and then respond. And he's, and I think the neuroscience is more or less starting to bear this out. They're going to be this split-second reactive response at almost the same time, but actually in the way that Buddha talked about, just a tad before the mind even fully identifies what it is. Because that next step, the third aspect, third aggregate, is perception. And the perception is hearing the sound, judging them, or the sensory input, judging it to be pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral, and then labeling it, giving it a name. Oh, that's, you know, that's not an RPG, it's a car backfiring. Right? Being able to interpret, to distinguish the thing. But in order to do that, then you dredge up the memory. Last time I heard that sound, okay? And then that can trigger either memories or thoughts about the future. But I think the way you're describing it, it is, you may be correct in terms of if you're talking, what you're talking about is vedana, which is the immediate judgment. Also, in terms of sensory inputs, there's not five senses in the this particular way of thinking about things, but six. The mind is actually the sixth sense, okay? The mind can be both a transmitter and a receiver, okay? So it can be a transmitter of a thought or a feeling that you judge to be pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. So you can have some disturbing thought come up and say, ew, you don't like that. Right? So you can judge your thoughts and your feelings to be pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral, just like you judge sensory stimuli to be the same. So in that way, I think, you can be correct. Good, okay. Yes, please.
At the beginning you mentioned five obstacles. The first was lust, the last was, fifth was doubt, and I wasn't quick enough to write down 2, 3, and 4.
Sure, yes. Lust or aggressive craving, okay. Second is aversion or anger. And so those sometimes one's taught first, sometimes the other. Okay. The third one is a sense of dullness, of deliberate not knowing. Okay. Fourth is restlessness, sometimes tinged with anxiety, and the fifth is doubt. And we'll get to know them in an excruciating detail over the course of the next couple of months. If you ever go on a intensive residential meditation retreat, pretty soon in on the retreat, someone's going to give a talk about the five hindrances, because they're a cause for discouragement and self-aversion. But what they actually signal, once the mind gets settled in and calm, is what the arising of the hindrances signals that the mindfulness is getting stronger and has become threatening to the construct itself. And so, you know, I sometimes talk about them as the deflector shields in the starship ego. You know, they arise. I mean, they're kind of designed into the system in order to prevent the deconstruction itself.
Some of us have a patent for that.
Please, in the back.
So I'm just kind of unpacking this idea of projecting the self onto the
experiences
you have.
Yes.
And so I'm kind of understanding it in two different ways. One being like, so you walk outside and it's really bright. If you're in kind of a bad mood or having a bad day, you're like, oh God, it's too bright. But if you're in a good mood and have a good day, you're like, oh wow, this is beautiful. This is
Thank
beautiful.
God the sun's shining again, right.
So that's one way of understanding it, but I'm also understanding it in a way of like, if you walk outside and you're in a bad mood, the day is literally gray or cloudy, but you if you're in a good mood, that it's sunny and beautiful out. So is there like an actual change in the external world, or is it just the subtext of the experience?
It's a good one. Anthropologists and philosophers have been trying to wrestle that one to the ground for a very long time. My own experience of depression has a physiological element to it. I tend to suffer from seasonal affective disorder, and sometimes I just get depressed anyway, can't even put a label on it. When it's really kind of bad, whether the sun's shining or not, the experience feels to me as if I am literally looking at the world through kind of a smoky lens. Things don't seem as vibrant and as colorful and as alive as they might be at other times. And I feel sort of one step removed, almost as if I'm experiencing life through a kind of a membrane, you know. And the Buddha actually spoke about this a little bit. He said, you know, when you're doing insight meditation practice and you get to where you can recognize what the mind's up to, that the meditator experiences the contracted mind as the contracted mind. That you know that for whatever reason, you're in such a bad space, you know, the dukkha being what it is, that you have literally withdrawn from the world. And your senses are kind of dulled or deadened, you know, because you're trying to not be there. You know. It's one of the forms of dukkha, which is a desire not to exist. And so that's my experience of it. And the flip side, you know, if for whatever reason, you know, the samadhi is deep, there's nothing troubling going on in my life or whatever, and I just wake up and go outside and the day is kind of clear and sparkling, because that's sort of been removed. And as to which it is, what's going on, one of the subjects I've studied off and on and used in my research over the years is anthropology, and there is this famous kind of dialogue going on within, especially among the linguists, one saying that we all experience the same reality, but we have different words for it depending on the importance that our culture ascribes. And then there are other linguists that say, well, you know, language is so core and so crucial and so central, and because we literally think in words, they're actually of the view that people with radically different language structures perceive a different physical world. Actually, perceive the world literally differently. See it differently, literally. Yeah. Who knows?
But everybody sees reality differently, even in the same language.
And in the Buddha's teaching is actually in some ways even more radical than that. Because as he goes stepwise through the Mahisatipatthana Sutta, he talks about how, you know, the mind becomes progressively more relaxed. Once you get past the hindrances and you can see more clearly what's going on, then you see the skandhas, the five aggregates, you watch the mind literally constructing the self, and then the mind gets relaxed beyond that point where it ceases to construct the self. And you see the world from a non-self-referential point of view. If the mind continues to get more relaxed beyond that, you see the mind actually constructing the environment. You see the mind, you perceive the mind to take in sensory stimuli and give it a name. And this tends to happen in the states of deep meditative absorption. then what happens next is you can relax the mind to where it no longer does that, where there is sensory stimuli but it's not labeled. And at that point, the mind has also ceased to construct reality. It's literally ceased to construct the environment. Okay. That is called shunyata. So anatta is voidness of self. Shunyata is voidness of all reality. And so when you hear the Buddha talk about the deathless, that which was never born can never die. So we get to the point where we're no longer birthing the self. That which is not born cannot die. And that's what experiencing the deathless means. And on that happy note, and it is one, we've run out of time.
I would love to continue on this theme.
All right. Next time.
Can we do it next
time? We will. We'll do shunyata and the hindrances. All right, let's settle in, if we might, please, just for one moment. Back into our sitting posture. May we all live with ease, safe from all inner and outer harm. May we experience the joy within us and be happy. May we rest in silence and stillness and know inner peace. May we rest in generosity and kindness of heart, one with all beings. May we awaken and be free. Safe journey home.